This is the 2017 Pacific Northwest Daughters of Sarah Weekend. Brother Roger Lewis is leading our studies on the topic, Hannah, Handmaid of the Highest. This is class two, entitled Hannah and Her Vow. The introductory reading was 1 Samuel 1, verses 9 through 18.
Well, good afternoon. Shall we carry on? So remember, we left our story, didn't we, in our first study, in that eighth verse of 1 Samuel chapter 1, where it was clear that even though Elkanah loved his wife, he didn't really understand where she was in mind. And that wasn't because Hannah had deliberately concealed the matter from her husband. It's because she thought on a spiritual plane that was different to Elkanah. So the record says in verse 9 that Hannah rose up after they had eaten in Shiloh and after they had drunk. Now you'll notice that the record isn't specific as to who ate and who drank, but on the basis of verse 7, and from a later verse that we'll come across in this study, I suggest that the word they in verse 9, after they had eaten and after they had drunk, in fact refers to everyone else in the family apart from Hannah herself. That she didn't share in the fellowship meal because she felt she couldn't, because her mind was in such turmoil and her grief was so strong that she felt that there was a rupture in the principles of fellowship and she was unable to participate. But you see, even though her distress prevented her from joining, she waited until after they had finished. Do you notice that? So she didn't disturb the fellowship meal for others, despite her own pain that she may have had at the time. No, she waited till instead after the meal was over, before they left the immediate vicinity of the tabernacle, and then when the meal was over for everybody else, Hannah arose to commune with God in private prayer. She went back to the sanctuary, which must have been close by. See, they'd gone up and they'd offered their offerings and they'd given the part for the priest and the part for God, and then they've taken their part, and close by, just outside the sanctuary, there was obviously places where the Israelites that came could eat their fellowship meal. And so she has now moved close by to return to the sanctuary while the rest of the family has gone back to wherever they were actually encamped at the time. She left quietly and discreetly. You can almost hear her in verse 9, that after they all rose up, she said, look, I'll just offer a final prayer to God and then I'll come back and I'll see you shortly. So she walked alone, you see, back into the temple. And she walked alone because no one else really understood. Verse 9 says that Eli, the priest, sat upon a seat by the post of the temple of Yahweh. Interestingly, do you notice it's not Eli the judge? Even though he was one for about 40 years, says the 1 Samuel chapter 4, verse 18, he judged Israel for 40 years. No, this story is about priesthood. This story is all about priesthood and the challenge of a corrupt priesthood that distressed Hannah. To Eli the priest, is sitting upon a seat by a post of the temple. And of course, clearly what we understand from that phrase, sat upon a seat, is that already the priesthood has moved the ancient landmark. Because one of the remarkable things was this about the law of Moses. In Deuteronomy chapter 10, verse 8, we shan't turn it up, but let me just read it for you. In Deuteronomy 10, verse 8, it says, at that time, Yahweh separated the tribe of Levi to bear the Ark of the Covenant of Yahweh, to stand before Yahweh to minister unto him. To stand before him to minister. You see, the surprising thing is that in the whole of the service of the law of Moses, the priests always stood. Everything they did, they stood. There was no sitting. In fact, there were no seats. There was no seat anywhere in the tabernacle. There was no seat in the temple. The only seat in the tabernacle was the mercy seat, and that seat belonged to God and not to man. Now, you could argue, couldn't you, that perhaps Eli had a seat here because he was an old man, which indeed he was. He was probably over 80 by the time the 1 Samuel chapter 1 occurs. So maybe it was simply that he was an old man. But the word seat here, out of the 135 times it's used, is translated 127 times as throne. Eli had established a throne. See, this wasn't just because he was tired. This was a throne of authority. This was a seat of honor from which he might make pronouncements. And if we were to ask where this seat was that no priest ought to have had, we're told in the end of the verse that he sat upon a seat which was by the post of the temple of Yahweh. Eli's seat was next to a doorpost of the temple. Now, incidentally, we know from the 1 Samuel chapter 2 and verse 22 that what was in Shiloh was the tabernacle of the congregation that was set up there in Joshua chapter 18. It was the tabernacle. It was the tabernacle of Moses. So why is it called the temple here? The word actually means palace. And it appeared that the reason why it was called a palace is that at some stage when the tabernacle of the congregation was set up in Shiloh, that they built a porch out at the front of the entrance, at the very entrance to the sanctuary, beyond which no Israelite, of course, could enter. And out there, at the front porch, as it were, they'd erected a structure nearby the doorposts. And where that porch was, that's partly why it's now called the palace, Eli's got his seat right out the front, so he can see the worshippers coming and going, and he can have conversation with them and make pronouncements to them. So whenever Hannah came to make petition, and she would only be permitted to that boundary, which was the front entrance porch, she was close enough for Eli to see her, and obviously close enough for Eli to speak with her, which he's going to do later on in this particular story. But the very fact that there's a seat there at all is a mark of the apostasy of Eli's household from what the law of God requires, that all priests should stand. And the record says in verse 10, she was in bitterness of soul. Now, it's a funny thing, you know, that the anguish of sorrow and the ecstasy of joy are such intensely personal things that I don't know that anyone else ever fully knows how we think or feel, either in our darkest moments of sorrow or our brightest moments of joy. No one else really understands. Now let me show you three passages just to illustrate that, because it's a scriptural idea, I think. If you come to the book of Proverbs, chapter 14, when it says, in other words, when it says that Hannah was in bitterness of soul, no one could understand really how Hannah felt. Only Hannah could. And the proverb says this, you see. Proverbs chapter 14 and verse 10 puts it this way. The Authorized Version says, "The heart knoweth his own bitterness, and a stranger doth not intermeddle with his joy." The New International Version says, "Each heart knows its own bitterness, and no one else can share its joy." There's truth in that, isn't there? Each heart knows its own bitterness. No one else can share its joy, or for that matter, its sorrow. This is something that we all carry as a private burden, that finally no one else really knows. Not our dearest friend, and in this case, not even Hannah's husband. And here's a second passage. It's in the 1 Corinthians chapter 2. And verse 11, something similar to the spirit of Proverbs chapter 14. 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verse 11 says, says, "For what man knoweth the things of a man, save the spirit of man which is in him?" So the Revised Version, Revised Standard Version, translates the 1 Corinthians 2 verse 11 by saying, "For what person knows a man's thoughts except the spirit of the man which is in him?" In other words, what it's saying is no one else knows your thoughts apart from you yourself. No one else really knows what goes on inside the thoughts of a man or a woman. And here's a third passage, a very interesting one in the context of our study. Do you remember the prayer of Solomon at the time of the dedication of the temple? It's in the 1 Kings chapter 8, and just see what he says. 1 Kings chapter 8, verses 38 and 39. It says there, in language that is certainly connected in thought to our study, he says, Solomon says, verse 38, "What prayer and supplication soever be made of any man, by any man, or by all the people of Israel, which shall know every man the plague of his own heart, and spread forth his hands toward this house." Did you see that? Whoever makes prayer by any man, which shall know every man the plague of his own heart. The New International Version says, "Each one aware of the afflictions of his own heart. Then hear thou in heaven thy dwelling place, and forgive and do and give to every man according to his ways, whose heart thou knowest, for thou, even thou, only knowest the hearts of all the children of men." And clearly the implication of Solomon's prayer is that the only person that really knows outside of ourselves what our hearts, what our thoughts, what our grief really is Almighty God. Nobody else, no other living person really knows. Even when we say that we know how someone else is feeling, we can't. Even when we think it's the same grief that we've got, you don't see it from their perspective. You don't understand it from their perspective. And you see, what we're being told here in these passages, when it says in the 1 Samuel chapter 1 and verse 10 that she was in bitterness of soul, Hannah was on a journey that no one else could share with her. Our deepest emotions are incommunicable to others. And that's why Elkanah didn't really know the depth of Hannah's soul. He cared for her, he loved her, but he couldn't enter into this. So she did the right thing, didn't she? Verse 10. She prayed unto Yahweh. Which is really our board, isn't it? She turned to God. And that's the thing, you see, that when there is no one else, we can always come to God. And that's what the faithful do. Even in the face of extreme adversity, they retain their personal integrity before God and they maintain their absolute trust in Him. See, the thing about child, it's a funny thing, is that our childs can either separate us from the Father or they can draw us closer to Him. It all depends on where we sit, you see. And finally, isn't it true that God is the one that permits these circumstances to enter into our lives? God permits pain, God permits grief, so that our own weaknesses and our own inability to solve life's problems are finally made clear to us. And we recognize our complete dependence upon Him, that we can't solve them. God takes us on the journey precisely for that reason, that we might be brought to that level of understanding. So she did the right thing. She prays to God. Because, you see, it's out of these distressing situations that good can come, provided we respond in faith like Hannah did. And the lesson of this story is that God can save men and women out of the most evil, out of the most difficult circumstances. But He does require first that we've learned to trust in Him. We've learned to surrender to His will. And that's what Hannah does, you see. She comes to surrender to God. And so verse 11 says, she vowed a vow. And she said, "O Yahweh of hosts, if thou wilt indeed look on the affliction of thine handmaid." And one of the reasons for perhaps assuming that she didn't eat in verse 9 is precisely because she's making a vow in verse 11. And what one customarily did before making a vow was to fast. To fast and then to pray and then to make a vow. And that's exactly, I think, what Hannah did. She fasted and then she prayed and then she vowed a vow. And her vow was unto Yahweh of hosts, to the God who both created and controlled the hosts of heaven. All the angels are God's creation. You know that Hannah's the first person in Scripture to utter that title in prayer to God. O Yahweh Tzevaoth, O Yahweh of hosts. And incidentally, I think that's exactly what it means. I know sometimes we say it's Yahweh of armies, and there may be an application, but the real meaning of Tzevaoth is hosts, multitudes. She prays to the God who's the God of multitudes. O God of multitudes, O God of all the hosts of heaven, could you not just grant me one? See, she chose that title with care, didn't she? She prays to Yahweh, who's the God of all the hosts that come under his sovereign control. And so she says, verse 11, if thou wilt indeed look on the affliction of thine handmaid. Now, do you notice that word is used three times in this verse, thine handmaid. Thine handmaid, thine handmaid. Now the word handmaid here, amar, means a maid servant. And it's a title of service, a title of humility, and a title of resignation to his will. And she's going to address herself directly before God in such a way. And I think that when you look at that phrase, that look on the affliction of thine handmaid, that what she really means and how she's really using that title is that she wanted to be Yahweh's instrument for salvation, which she knew that she herself could not accomplish. She knew what the nation needed. One vow probably is not enough to solve a nation's problem, but she did what she could. You see, she thought deeply about the problems of the ecclesia and its spiritual condition. Incidentally, that's what spiritual men and women do. They think about the problems of ecclesial life. They don't just think about themselves. They don't even just think about their own family. They think about the ecclesia. They think about the brotherhood. They think about the mystical body of Christ. They worry about the problems in that community. That's what Hannah did. And sometimes those difficulties bring us to tears. But you see, God looks for that in our lives, and God can harness that spirit. And the key thing here in all of her grief and in all of her bitterness to realize is that Hannah was not motivated by selfishness, but by love. She was not a woman desperate for a child, but she understood that the nation was desperate for a saviour. And that's why she's praying this prayer. Her thinking is well above simply her own needs. And so she says, if thou wilt give unto thine handmaid a man child, I will give him unto the Lord. So you see, right from the beginning, Hannah does not want a child for the sake of having a child. That's quite clear when you think about it in the record. She wanted a man child. Notice, she didn't want a girl. She wanted a boy. Because she wanted one who would be a teaching priest, a spiritual intercessor, a godly champion to restore the nation to true fellowship with God. And so she says, in effect, in this prayer, if you will give me that man child, I will consecrate him to be the priest after a higher order that the nation needs. And if I do that, may you then, O Yahweh of hosts, take him and use him for thy purpose. She asks for a son and immediately pledges to give him back. So you think about the logic of her prayer and her request in verse 11. If all she wanted was a son, why would she vow to make him a Nazarite in separation and a servant in dedication to God all his life? Now, this child was not for her. In fact, there's two parts to what she really asked, you know, in this verse. He was going to be given to God for life, which was beyond the normal terms, the normal limit of Levitical service. She wanted a son who'd be a Levite for life. Levites only serve between 30 and 50. She says, this Levite will serve for the rest of his life. And he will be a Nazarite. No razor shall come upon his head. He'll be a Nazarite for all his life, which is well beyond the normal scope of a Nazarite vow. When people made Nazarite vows, they normally came and vowed for a certain period of time to dedicate themselves to God in some special way. She said, no, all his life. Now, you don't ask for a son and then promise to give him back to God forever if your focus is on yourself, do you? You don't ask for a son and promise to give him back straight away forever if it was really all about you. And you see, it's not about Hannah at all. It's about a nation that needs redemption. And that was the cause and the source of her grief. So it says in verse 12, it came to pass as she continued praying before Yahweh that Eli marked her mouth. She prayed long. Margin says that she multiplied to pray. So she was praying and praying and praying and praying and praying. Now, it's an interesting thing because, you see, Eli noticed, because it was an unusual sight, first of all, to have anyone probably praying at the tabernacle of the congregation in those days. A woman who prayed was already an unusual sight, but a woman who prayed and prayed and prayed and prayed, and the old man looks and he can't understand it. You see, what he noticed was, the strange thing was, that he noticed her mouth, but she wasn't actually saying anything out loud. It was the most peculiar thing. She was obviously talking, but there was nothing coming out. It was the prayer of her heart, but she was so fervent in her prayer that without realizing it, she's actually speaking the words, but silently, but the mouth's moving. And the old man sees that and he's puzzled. Now, there's a lesson in verse 12. And the lesson is this. Have you ever offered a prayer for the needs of the ecclesia and prayed for 1 minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, 4 minutes, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 20 minutes? I don't think we pray like that, do we? We don't pray and pray and pray. And pray. We would struggle to do this because the very act of prayer, to focus the mind, to express our thoughts, to confess our need, to ask his help, to declare his righteousness, to seek his work, to accomplish his will, to accept what he decides, is so exhausting to the soul and the body and the mind that to pray and to pray and to pray is just so incredibly unusual. Here's the lesson. Only those can continue long in prayer who have practiced prayer. She didn't just come and offer a long prayer for the first time in her life. She prayed because she practiced prayer. Hannah probably wasn't doing anything different to what she normally did. She didn't just pray like this at the sanctuary. She knew how to multiply prayer. So the time sped away because she was lost in contact with her God, which, by the way, strangely, was the very fellowship she was seeking and couldn't find at the fellowship meal. But now she's with her God in prayer. And verse 13 said, now Hannah, she spake in her heart, only her lips moved, but her voice was not heard. Therefore Eli thought that she was drunken. So she spoke in her heart. Her prayer was so intense, and yet it was still private. And see, the interesting thing is that, you see, Hannah wasn't displaying anything ostentatiously. She wasn't giving a learned recitation. She wasn't dramatizing her grief by wailing and lamenting. She was absolutely quiet apart from the moving of her lips. Her prayer in grief was in fact a prayer in private. And Eli, of course, completely misunderstands and misreads the situation. And so he says, verse 14, Eli said unto her, how long wilt thou be drunken? Put away thy wine from me. And he was quick to rebuke what he took to be drunken behavior. But of course, you realize why he said that, is that's probably what Eli had seen before at the tabernacle of the congregation. Other women had arrived drunken at the door. So he sees what he thinks is another one of them. So he says, you go home and sleep your wine off. You shouldn't be here. Put it away. Now you see, if ever there was an indication that Hannah was all alone, it's here, isn't it? She's at the sanctuary of God in Shiloh, and two men absolutely fail her in her time of need. Elkanah tries to comfort her, but does not understand. Eli seeks to rebuke her and does not understand. She's all alone. And that's a state that many a godly person from time to time will find themselves in. But look at the spirit of her response when this man says, "How long wilt thou be drunken?" So in verse 15, Hannah answered and said, "No, my lord, I am a woman of a sorrowful spirit." You notice her respect for Yahweh's anointed priest? She knew that Eli's weakness had led to the evil of his sons, Hophni and Phinehas. She knew that this man was responsible for a corrupt priesthood. She knew that this man was the cause for the nation's ruptured fellowship with God. But such is her respect for the office of high priest that she still called him, "My Lord." "No, my Lord. I am a woman of a sorrowful spirit." Green's literal says, "I am pained in spirit." The New International Version says, "I am deeply troubled." And the sorrow of that pain and the anguish of that trouble had caused her to pour out her soul on this occasion before Yahweh with such intensity that her body swayed and her lips moved. But none of this was because she was drunken, as Eli had supposed. But the interesting thing is that when Eli says, "You're drunken," she doesn't say in response in verse 15, "No, my Lord, I'm not drunken." She doesn't use Eli's word at all. And her reply is not just a repudiation of Eli's charge, but a scriptural quotation, which Eli, of all people, should immediately have understood and known. She says, "I have drunk neither wine nor strong drink," she says to Eli. And that's a quotation from the Nazarite vow of Numbers chapter 6. Now come and have a look at it because, well, it's so marvelous, you see. And the story of the Nazarite vow is really critical to the story of Hannah. In terms of our understanding, there's an interweaving of thought here. So let's just come and have a look at this, Numbers chapter 6. This is what she quotes immediately, instantly, back to Eli in response to the charge of being drunken. The funny thing is, it was the very reverse, absolutely the reverse, in terms of the spirit and the conduct of this woman. Now you see what Numbers 6 says, verse 1. Yahweh spake unto Moses, saying, "Speak unto the children of Israel, and say unto them, when either man or woman shall separate themselves to vow a vow of a Nazarite to separate themselves unto Yahweh." Oh, did you notice that? Just like the peace offering was partaken of by both male and female, the Nazarite vow, especially and uniquely in the law, was a vow open to both male and female, to both brother and sister alike. They could either vow a vow of dedication to serve their God. But as part of that vow, this was what was required of them, verse 3. "He shall separate himself from wine and strong drink, and shall drink no vinegar of wine or vinegar of strong drink, neither shall he drink any liquor of grapes, nor eat moist grapes or dried. All the days of his separation shall he eat nothing that's made of the vine tree, from the kernels even to the husk. All the days of the vow of his separation there shall no razor come upon his head until the days be fulfilled in which he separateth himself unto Yahweh. He shall be holy and let the locks of the hair of his head grow." And so when she says in the 1st of Samuel chapter 1 and verse 15, "I've drunk neither wine nor strong drink," she's actually quoting from the law of the Nazarite vow. And that separation from wine and strong drink was associated with the idea of having mental clarity. And Hannah's use of those two words tells us that she's got that vow in mind. But see, what's interesting is that when she quotes that in the 1 Samuel 1, verse 15, she says, I've drunk neither wine nor strong drink. She's not talking about the Nazarite dedication of her son. Remember she vowed, no razor will come upon his head, back in verse 11? If you give me this child, no razor shall come upon his head. But she's not talking about the subsequent dedication of Nazariteship of a son yet to be born. This is a vow of Nazarite dedication upon Hannah herself. And incidentally, in fact, I shouldn't have gone off number 6 quite so early. Just come back to number 6 in case you've already moved from it. And let me just show you the climax of the Nazarite vow and how appropriate it is in the context of the story of Hannah. So do you know how the Nazarite vow finishes? It finishes like this. In verse 18, the Nazarite shall shave the head of his separation at the door of the tabernacle of the congregation, take the hair of the head of his separation, put it on the fire, which is under the sacrifice of the peace offerings. Well, well, well. They were to take the hair of their glorious Nazarite separation and they were to throw it on the fire where the peace offerings were. And incidentally, what would happen is there'd be this huge burst of flame as the hair caught fire underneath the peace offerings. And then what happened was this, verse 19. The priest took the sodden shoulder of the ram and one unleavened cake out of the basket, unleavened wafer, and put them on the hands of the Nazarite after the hair of his separation is shaven. And the priest shall wave them for a wave offering before Yahweh. This is holy for the priest with the wave breast and heave shoulder. And after that, the Nazarite may drink wine. Do you know what actually happened? What happened is when the Nazarite had completed their vow, the peace offerings were made on the fire. The hair was thrown underneath it. And then part of the offering, which normally belonged to the priest, the sodden shoulder, verse 19, the priest on this occasion took that meat and put it on the hands of the Nazarite. Nazarite held their hands out, put the meat on, put the unleavened wafers on, and then the Nazarite put, the priest put their hands under the Nazarite's hands, and they waved that sacrifice together before Yahweh. And in that moment, the Nazarite became one with the priest, and one in fellowship with God. Do you think that's where Hannah's heart was? Do you think that's what she yearned for? That's how a Nazarite vow was accomplished. And a peace offering shared with the priest who waved it together with you on that day. Do you think Hophni and Phinehas would ever do that with her? Or for her? And Eli says, you're drunken. Oh, he had no idea of the woman in front of him, did he, on this occasion? And she says, no, my Lord. I'm a woman of sorrowful spirit. I've drunk neither wine nor strong drink. That's exactly what she was referring to. And there was there not, a relatively recent case which Hannah was probably aware of, to which she was also referring. And that, of course, is the case of the book of Judges, chapter 13, and Samson's mother. Because now we understand from our studies that Samson's only a very short while before the story of Samuel. And you see what it says, if we come back to Judges chapter 13, there's no doubt that these are the thoughts in Hannah's mind when she uses that particular phrase, I've drunk neither wine nor strong drink. So you see what it says in Judges 13. A barren woman is visited by God and she's given a threefold admonition. Here it is, verse 4, Judges 13 verse 4. Now therefore beware, I pray thee, and drink not wine nor strong drink, nor any unclean thing, for lo, thou shalt conceive and bear a son, and no razor shall come upon his head, for the child shall be a Nazarite unto God from the womb. You drink no wine nor strong drink because of the child you're about to bring forth. Here's the second admonition, verse 7. He said unto me, behold, thou shalt conceive and bear a son, and now drink no wine nor strong drink, neither eat any unclean thing, for the child shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb to the day of his death. the womb to the day of his death. What did Samuel say about her child? No razor shall come upon his head, and I'll give him to Yahweh all the days of his life, from the womb to the day of his death. And lastly, in Judges 13, the angel of God will say in verse 13, the angel of Yahweh said unto Manoah, of all that I said unto the woman, let her beware, that she may not eat of anything that cometh of the vine, neither let her drink wine or strong drink. So there was a remarkable parallel here. And this was the birth of a child only shortly before, relatively shortly before, in the history of Israel, that no doubt Hannah might well have heard of. The remarkable story of the angel that disappeared in the flame of fire. But you see, unlike Manoah's wife, Hannah didn't need any angel to come and tell her not to drink wine or strong drink. She didn't wait for an angel to tell her, did she? She made that commitment herself. Because how does she make that commitment? In the voluntary spirit, which is the very spirit of the Nazarite vow, without compulsion and of her own free will, she made vow to do this in the spirit of the Nazarite law of Numbers chapter 6. And so she says in verse 16, count not thine handmaid for a daughter of Belial. Or as Rotherham says, do not count thy handmaid for an abandoned woman. And here's the strange thing, you see. Isn't it funny how life works out? Because you see, Eli criticizes Hannah, and Hannah says, do not consider me to be a daughter of Belial. He had completely misinterpreted her actions and completely misread her motives. And yet as high priest, he's supposed to have compassion on those who are in need, but he failed Hannah on this occasion. You see what it says concerning his own boys in chapter 2, verse 12? Count not thine handmaid for a daughter of Belial, says Hannah. Chapter 2, verse 12. Now the sons of Eli, they were sons of Belial. And the very man that criticizes Hannah on this occasion has children who are the very embodiment of all the evil that he supposedly saw in Hannah, and presume to criticize her about. Out of the abundance of my complaint and grief, she says, have I spoken hitherto. Well, fortunately, Eli was obviously impressed with, in fact, what Hannah's response was. Not only with the truthfulness of her response, but I think that Eli heard her well enough to know that she was quoting from Numbers chapter 6. Because you see what he says in response, verse 17. Then Eli answered and said, go in peace, and the God of Israel grant thee thy petition which thou hast asked of him. Now, let me tell you something interesting about the Nazarite vow. We shan't turn it up again, but do you know how the law of the Nazarite finishes, or how Numbers chapter 6 finishes? When the Nazarite vow is completed, it records the priestly blessing. Do you remember the priestly blessing? Yahweh bless thee and keep thee. Yahweh make his face to shine upon thee and be gracious unto thee. Yahweh lift up his countenance upon thee. And how does it finish? Give thee peace. And Eli says, go in peace. Ooh, where did you get that word from? He gives her the priestly blessing of the Nazarite vow. And you know what that word's related to? Go in peace. It's the peace offering. The final fellowship joy of the peace offering. The one thing that Hannah can't reach. The one thing that Hannah can't find. And now Eli the priest says, go in peace. And the basis on which that peace, that final fellowship, might come to pass in your life is that the God of Israel grant thee thy petition, which thou hast asked of him. Now, I don't think this is a prediction. I don't think that he's making a prophecy that God would grant it, but he's certainly adding his blessing as high priest that it might be so, that God might fulfill her desires in whatever she had prayed for. Do you know that Eli had no idea at this moment of how revolutionary Hannah's going to be in the nation that he was high priest over. He had no idea when he said, God grant thee thy petition, that that awareness of the things that Hannah was thinking about, praying about, yearning for, that if they were granted by God, it would set in train a spirit of such change that would reach out and overthrow his family. His household would be destroyed if this all came to pass. He had no idea of what was going on this day. But he says nevertheless, and no doubt deservedly so in terms of the providence of God, he says, go in peace, and may the God of Israel grant thee thy petition which thou hast asked of him. And she said, verse 18, she said, let thine handmaid find grace in thy sight. Notice again that spirit of respect for the high priest. Let thy handmaid find grace. Now, incidentally, isn't that the term she uses in her prayer to God in verse 11? Thine handmaid, thine handmaid, thine handmaid. And now she says to the high priest, let thine handmaid find grace. Do you know why she used that term to Eli? Because the high priest is Yahweh's representative. She recognized that. But Eli had forgotten what that really meant. And now the marvelous thing is, verse 18 says, so the woman went her way and did eat, and her countenance was no more sad. So it's a marvelous example, really, of how prayer helps to settle the heart and the mind. You see, despite the fact she hadn't yet received an answer from God, she committed the matter to God. There's a tremendous difference, isn't there, between having grief that you haven't yet brought to God and having grief that we have brought to God. She's brought it to God now. That's a huge difference. Because she brought it to him, she rested in that. Outwardly, her circumstances hadn't changed. But she's somehow now joyous and resolute and full of assurance that her prayer will be answered. So whoever this woman was when she came to pray, and her bitterness of soul and depth of grief, it's a different woman now that goes back to join the family. Can you just imagine Hannah walking in back to the family after this moment in the tabernacle, after this prayer, after this conversation? She walks back into the household, and she's a woman prepared in heart, tranquil of spirit. She's ready to eat in peace and fellowship with God and to be made whole in the partaking of her portion. Go in peace, Eli had said, and that's exactly what she did. She went away. It's as if the spirit of Ecclesiastes chapter 9 and verse 7 rested upon her, which says, go thy way, eat thy bread with joy, and drink thy wine with a merry heart, for God now accepteth thy works. And so she did. She went back, says the record, and she did eat bread. But notice carefully that the record never says, unlike verse 9, that she drank. They ate and drank, verse 9. Hannah eats. She didn't drink. Her vow of Nazariteship for her son extended to a Nazarite vow upon herself, that not only in his life, but even in his conception, and even in his bearing in her womb, he would be a holy child. And that Nazarite vow of not partaking of wine or strong drink began, as far as she was concerned, now. Before the child had even been conceived, she would be ready for that possibility. And in that newfound peace and happiness, that vow would stand, must stand, as she awaited the day of Yahweh's visitation in her life. But there was a problem. And the problem was this, that the law of God made express provision that all that she had pledged and everything she had vowed might be set aside by her husband if he did not endorse it. Isn't that what the law of Moses said? That unless her husband endorsed it, the vow did not stand. And her vow was extremely unusual in a sense, because she wasn't asking Elkanah for the chance to have a son. She was going to promise to take that son away from him if he was born. So the question was, would he endorse or would he disannul? Would he permit or would he disallow? Well, that problem, and what he did, is the story of our next study. So at that point, we close the record. It's always good, isn't it, to have something left to carry on with in a story. Now, there is a closing hymn with which we will close, and that's hymn 157. Do you notice that both 156 and 157 use the word vows? And that's what we've been talking about this morning, the vow of Hannah, this afternoon, the vow of Hannah. So let's close with hymn 157, and then at the end of this, there won't be a closing prayer, we're going through till dinner time till prayer, but can I just suggest that you all get up and stretch your legs for a couple of minutes after the hymn, and then we'll reconvene for the workshop to follow. So hymn 157, and reading from the second verse, our vows, our prayers, we now present before thy throne of grace, God of the fathers, be the God of their succeeding race. 157.